friendly with Jan Moore, who was assistant private sec in our office. And so, you know, when we had a vacancy, she came over and joined the Holt staff. And subsequently, she went back to the PM's department. And then last I heard, she was assistant official secretary at Government House. So there's no way now, current times, you'd think about, or the staff would allow you to think about employing someone from the opposition's office, I wouldn't think.
This might be an opportunity to talk about this a bit, Frank. When do you think that changed? It's a really shift in the culture, isn't it?
Oh, it's a big shift in the culture. I think it would have been in 72, the Whitlam coming to power time, when a lot of the appointees were... See, in opposition, I think you tend to get more people wanting to work in shadow minister's office or members of parliament office who are dedicated party people and supporting the cause rather than sort of being there for a career advancement or an experience that might help your career advancement down the track, as was the case with a lot of the government stuff. In my day, a lot of the a large majority would have been public servants who were just seconded to the job for a couple of years, and then because it gave them experience of what was needed in Parliament and Cabinet and what politicians needed, what ministers needed, they could go back into the department, and that adds to the pool of information in the public service, which spreads through the service and therefore is more help to the ministers down the track. Well, at least that's the theory, and I'm pretty sure that worked in practice. So I think it was probably in the Whitlam days where you got more politically dedicated people involved in ministerial staff, and certainly later on in the Hawke time, 83. I should come to that later on in more sequence, I think.
Yes, okay, all right, good.
Your question was what happened to me when I left here.
Right.
Well, after this function, I went back to the department, and I was senior advisor, parliamentary and government branch, and again appointed Secretary of the Federal Executive Council with Lord Casey as Governor-General at the time. I got involved in things like electoral commission work, where population changes after a census sort of meant that the population had changed and you needed to set up an electoral commission to change boundaries or look at boundaries. Involved in the preparation of the yes-no case that was required for the referendum in 67, which was the Aboriginal and also there was a parliamentary one as well at the time involved in that. Generally in that sort of whatever came up, and certainly involved in some of the cabinet secretariat work. I remember one project I had was to determine the effect of advice from Prime Minister's department on recommendations from other ministers, other departments, to cabinet. The departments prepare their submissions, or ministers on behalf of, for ministers. Ministers sign submission to cabinet, which is then circulated to various departments, and all of them were circulated to Prime Minister's department, and Prime Minister's department would look at it and advise the PM as to whether the recommendation should be accepted as is, whether it should be a committee or more inquiries or whatever. So that was an interesting exercise, going through several years of submissions and seeing what the department recommendation was and what the final decisions were. So, you know, there was these interesting sort of exercises cropped up from time to time.
What did you find, by the way?
I found that from memory, I've tried to find this paper in archives, but it doesn't seem to be there, or at least I haven't been able to locate it. From recollection, I think I found that something like more than half, or 60 or 70% of the decisions, the recommendations of the Premier's department had some effect on it. You know, whether it was just that there should be further information from a particular department or a particular area, or whether a committee should be set up to look at more detail. Because I think I mentioned earlier that the basic function of the department at that stage was, as presented to us, was to make sure that the cabinet sort of stuff coming forward fitted in with overall government policy. So it was in that sort of context that you might have said, well, you know, this might be a good recommendation, but how does it fit in with what the government has said in the, you know, policy speech at the election or something? So that was the nature of some of that sort of work. I also then moved around the department a bit, sort of filling in for assistant secretaries from time to time in the parliamentary and government branch, and also in education, cultural affairs. So I got a fair mix of that. Until after. And then on Holt's death, I had a major job come the funeral service in Melbourne, in that I was put in charge of a team to look after transport arrangements for, there were something like 26 heads of government came to Australia for the funeral, including Johnson, President Johnson. But the hospitality branch that normally handles these sort of visits can't handle 26 visits at one go. Virtually the whole department was thrown into organising this funeral. And my particular role was to look after transport arrangements once people hit the country, you know, whether they arrived in Sydney, getting them to Melbourne, and so on. And that was, you know, I probably had a group of six or eight people sort of around and running on timetables and keeping in touch with the Commonwealth car people in Sydney, Canberra and Melbourne, and telling them who was coming when and how many cars were needed, and also in contact with the Commonwealth Police and so on for handling the security aspects of, you can imagine, with Johnson's and so on. So that was turmoil. And I remember I worked for 3 days and nights with 2 hours sleep. And that just gets hectic. And I remember Nora Mills, who used to work in registry at Prime Minister's Department, would come in every now and again with a tray of sandwiches, and sometimes later in the day she'd come in with a tray of tinnies as well. So we'd get a bit of relaxation. But I was I was on the last plane going out of Canberra to Melbourne to go to the funeral myself. I had a police escort to get me from the airport to the funeral on time. I remember after the service, when people were gathering for the, you know, wake, get-together sort of type thing, Jack Bunting called me aside and said, "Frank, when you're organising these ministers back to Canberra, and of course there's all the rumbling now about succession. He said, there are five ministers. I don't want any two of these on the one plane. He said, McEwen, McMahon, Gorton, Fairhall. Who have I missed? Gorton, McMahon, McEwen, Fairhall. Oh, I think there's another one. But he said, and he was thinking of this, you know, the crash out from here with when three ministers were killed in one hit. He said, I don't want any of those. So I didn't have enough aircraft to make this sort of split. So I talked to the people at the RAF people, and they converted a DC-3 supply plane, I think I'd had photographic equipment in it. They whipped that equipment out and put a few seats in, and so we allocated that one to Billy McMahon. He wasn't particularly impressed that he was given the DC-3, but it was the only way I found that I could meet the boss's requirements of keeping all these people apart.
The fifth one wasn't Fraser, was it?
Fraser. It'd be Fraser, yeah. Yes.
Yeah, interesting.
So, you know, that was, you know, some of the interesting bits.
Shall we continue in that chronological order? What do you think next?
Next, with my Secretary of the Executive Council capacity, there was some work then too in terms of commissioning McEwen and people as Prime Minister and so on, and commissioning the new any new ministers and things like that. And then the same sort of thing when Gorton was elected, 6 weeks after or whatever it was. And when Gorton sort of selected his ministry, I would have to prepare the commissions for the Governor General to sign, and the only way I could keep this sort of secret and so on was I would have to go to the printers in the middle of the night to check their printing to make sure the commissions are printed properly. And so I'd do the proofreading of the commissions rather than have someone else do it, before they were then sent to Government House for signature by the Governor General. So yeah, got a bit involved there as well. And then, of course, John Gorton appointed Len Newart, now Sir Lennox Hewart, as his permanent head. Hewart had worked for Gorton as when he was Education Minister, I think, as head of as a Universities Commission or an Education Commission or something. And Hewart was a very hard public servant from Treasury. Different style completely to what we'd had before in Prime Minister's Department, whereas you'd had the Brown, Bunting, Yeand type people as long-term, what do you call them, diplomatic type permanent heads who would persuade people to come to the PM's point of view or whatever. Hewart was the sort of permanent head who, if the PM wanted something, the PM got it, and that's it. It was a much harsher sort of administration. Not much room for negotiation at all. And you can imagine my concern when a couple of months, probably only a month or two after Gorton was appointed, Len Hewart sort of called me into his office, and I thought, What have I done? What have I done? I mean, permanent heads don't call you in for no good reason normally. And they said, sit down, Frank. PM's going overseas on two trips shortly. He's going to America and to Asia. Which one do you want to go on? And I was shocked. And I said, well, and a bit cheeky, I thought. I said, well, I've been to Asia twice. I think I'll go to America. And it was like that. He said, right. He said, that's on in 10 days. Here's the list of people going. Fix it. This is the people going. This is the itinerary. Fix it. So I took my lists back to my room and started to fix. That was a real eye-opening trip, that one. Completely different style of administration. I know Menzies has been talked about as being arrogant, but if ever there was an arrogant Prime Minister, it's Gordon. And Gordon would only accept advice from certain people, and was a very few people. He couldn't stand foreign affairs, couldn't stand a lot of the people in Prime Minister's department, and he wouldn't take any notice of a lot of their advice. Basically, the only advice he'd take much notice of was Hewitt, his wife Bettina, Ainsley Gatto, who was about 21 or something at the time, was appointed and had been working for the Whip and appointed as a senior private sec, and Tony Eagleton. They were the four who were, you know, right in. And I'm sure there are a number of senior public servants that worked around the time that have caught the edge of Hewitt's tongue and whipped into gear to do things that they didn't think were quite appropriate on the basis of background. So it was a completely different administration at that time. And I found that people in the Prime Minister's department started to try to guess what Hewitt wanted. Not a good move. If he asked my advice, I would give it to him on the basis of what background experience I had. And if he changed it, well, that was his business. But some other members of the department tried to guess what Hewitt wanted, and that was something that not too many of them could guess. And some of them fell in a bit of a hole that way. I think some of them couldn't understand why Hewitt accepted, you know, like why I got the offer of this first trip, sort of, for instance. And another thing he threw my way was they changed the format of cabinet submissions. And they wanted the basic submission, and then they wanted a one sheet cover page, which summarised the argument and the recommendation. And if there would be other attachments, there would be attachments and indicated as such. And my job was, and this sort of format, the guidelines were sent to all departments, and all submissions before they got anywhere came to me, and I had to check them to see if they met this format. And I remember one came from the Department of Trade, and it didn't meet the format, and I rejected it and I sent it back. And the head of the Department of Trade rang Hewitt and said, look, this submission's got to go forward next week, and Jennings has knocked it back because it doesn't meet the format. He said, well, if Frank's knocked it back, it's knocked back. So he'd back you if you were, you know, sort of following the instructions. And so, you know, I found that quite rewarding, actually, that experience. But come the end of that year,
which is
67, 68 now. 68 now. I decided that I had enough of the public service, and there were a number of these people at my vintage, mid-30s, I was 38, people around my age, there were a number with blood pressure problems, a couple with heart problems, and I thought, oh, you know, this is not worth it, and I'm not seeing much of the kids. For that 12 months in 68, I was looking for farms in Queensland. Mm. I was going to pull the pin and run, which I did. That's another story again.
Can I just ask a bit more about Gorton?
Yes.
The trip to America, what was that for? What was the purpose behind that?
I think the purpose was simply to... I don't know if there was a specific thing behind it, but I think it was a goodwill thing, go to America and the relationship is the new prime minister sort of thing. I don't think there was much more to it than the goodwill thing. Oh, there would have been discussions on defence situations and foreign affairs relationships and things as well. But I'm not aware of any sort of particular pinpoint. I think it was Prime Minister's first year in office. Americans have got to get to know me, or I got to get to know the Americans. And then the next one to Asia was a similar goodwill thing. The trip itself, I think both John Gorton and Ainsley Gotto have written things in Women's Weeklies and Women's A New Idea or whatever on some of the aspects of that trip. But I think there are probably other stories to tell. But probably to give an indication of the Gorton attitude, we flew out of Australia to Hawaii the day before the Indian Prime Minister was to arrive in Australia. And the PM was going to have a day's holiday on the island of Maui. And the diplomatic thing about not staying here for the extra day to meet, to at least greet the Indian Prime Minister and just leave that to the Foreign Minister is one indication of how he looked at diplomacy and so on. I stayed in Honolulu as a communications type person while the rest of the party went off to Maui for a day's R&R. When President Johnson then sent Air Force One or Air Force Two, one of his aircraft, to Honolulu to pick us up as the party. And when we got on board, he had his hospitality ambassador, forget his name now, Duke seems to come to mind. When we got on board, this ambassador, fellow American ambassador, said, well, here's the seating plan, seating arrangements and so on. And Gorton said, no. I'll sit up, and the ambassador was to sit with the Prime Minister to brief him for the next part of the journey and for the trip, but he wasn't going to have that. Bettina and I and Tony and Len Hewitt will sit up here in this, like your first class apartment with a seating for four. We will be there. Ainsley and Frank will sit there, and you can sit there. This is talking to the American ambassador who's been sent by the president with the president's aircraft, the ambassador's wanting to brief the Prime Minister on the journey or the next part of the journey. But that was fairly indicative of the way he looked at other people and very much an IM sort of type attitude. And then when we arrived in Washington, the situation normally is if the you leave half a day spare in the first half day, and if the president's got the time, pre-time, and has the inclination, he will invite the PM and Mrs. PM onto the onto his private boat on the Potomac River, I think it is, for a personal get together before the tour starts, and this happened, and sometimes the ambassador, the Australian ambassador, is included. But when this was offered, the PM said, "I'm not going unless Len and Tony and Ainsley come with me." And this caused a bit of a diplomatic hoo-ha with the ambassador Waller, I think was our ambassador at the time. Waller couldn't convince Len Hewitt or the PM that that's not the way to go. That's the way I want to go. If he wants me to go and have a talk, I'll take these other people with me. So he did. Now you can imagine how that went down with the president, as wanting to get a personal sort of hand on this new prime minister. The other thing on the trip, the next thing I recall, we had there was a big dinner at the White House, and there were tables of about 8 or 10 people, big black tie dinner and so on. And I was, because this is one of the things when you're travelling in these small groups with Australian prime ministers, you know, even private secretaries like me, where you're thrown in with ministers and ministers' wives and whatever. So it's, you know, you don't drink too much. you control your tongue fairly well. But tremendous training in terms of conversational skill without leaking too much information, but trying to look interesting enough and interested enough. But I was sitting with the American Attorney General and his wife, and I remember there was an Australian there too, white-haired chap who was an astronomer, very well-known astronomer. But to me, my vision is he had a mop of white hair, something like Mark, something like Oliphant's. I just can't recall his name, but I think he was the chief astronomer at Stromlo or something at the time. So they did sort of try to get any prominent Australians that were in Washington at the time to mix in with the American ministers and so on. But after the dinner at the White House, President Johnson took us around with his wife to show us some of the thing, the ballroom and so on, and there was a bit of music playing, and Ainsley grabbed Johnson and said, "We're going to have a dance." Precocious little thing. There you go. You know, diplomacy, not way up front.
Well, it portrays Australia as a real backwater, doesn't it?
Yes, you know, yeah.
From the American point of view.
Yes, particularly when you've had people like Menzies and Holt trying to, you know, boost the image of Australia in that sort of area. So that's when the trip was over. Not too sure what month that was. Well, it must have been fairly early in the year. I just, you know, finished out my year in the department and then resigned and cashed my superannuation in and went farming in Queensland for a while. And I talk about cashing my superannuation in. It's not like it is today. I was 38, and of course, superannuation in the public service those days was a means of keeping you there at least till 60 or 65. No sympathy if you pulled out early. pulling out at 38 when I started at 21. The pound I put in 1951, I got back as $2 in 1968, less an administrative fee. And no counting for inflation. So you can imagine how much I lost on my superannuation. But anyway, that's the way it was.
I've been meaning to ask before we wind up today's session about the impact on your family, like the hours you worked and travel and so on.
The impact on the family was pretty severe. I think it got to the stage where the relationship had broken down. I felt that I wanted more time with the kids because they were growing up, and at this stage, I think the eldest would have been Narelle would have been at 12, I think, 11 or 12, 12, yeah, 12 or 13. So they would have been 12, 10, 8, no, 7, that sort of age. And they were, you know, often I'd get home when they're ready for bed, and then I'd leave before, you know, as they were getting ready for school. So I had little time with them. And I felt they were being brought up, their mother, who did a good job sort of caring for them, but some of her ideas and my ideas were didn't match. And I felt it was important that I should have some input into the kids' thinking. And that was one of the things behind my idea of going to the farm, apart from a personal thing about always feeling I had some affinity to the land. And the freedom of it, but I felt I'd have more time with the kids. My wife didn't accept that, and she decided she wasn't going to go in the long run. But she said, "Take what I'll cut that bit." So I went. I took the three eldest kids with me initially, and picked up my dad, who had retired from the farm, from a cane farm on the Richmond River, and he came up to set me straight on farming. He thought I was stupid. He said, "Leaving that good job and good secure job, and oh, did he cane me? Leaving that secure job for farming?" Couldn't understand that. "What are you thinking, old boy?" I said, "Well, that's the decision I made." But I finished up after about 4 or 5 months. Coming back to Canberra to pick up a couple more of my kids, and I finished up taking my wife and three more kids back to Queensland to give the relationship another go. So, and that finally cracked up in Queensland. But so the hours of work certainly do play up on relationships. I find it very difficult to perceive how, you know, relationships can cope with you know, one partner not being there a good bit of the time, particularly if you get some rivalry as to how the kids should be brought up and, you know, what paths they should take or how their education should be and all that sort of thing.
In a nutshell, can you explain what the difference was? How was your attitude different to education, for example?
Well, my attitude to education was different to my wife, because I felt that the girls needed a tertiary education as well as the boys, because relationships, you know, don't last forever, as our experience was indicating, and many other examples of our friends had indicated. Betty's view was the girls will only get married anyway, so they can go and work in a shop for a while, and that's all they should need until they get married. And mine was, even if they do go and get married, they need some training behind them so that if the marriage does break down, they're still protected. So that was a major sort of approach. Another major issue was religion, pushing them into religion at school or whatever. I was quite happy for them to consider any religion at all when they were 14 or 15 or when they were old enough to judge for themselves. But I didn't see how parents should be pushing kids into a religious situation, because I found in my own situation, you know, mum and dad were Anglican and Methodist, there was a, you know, dad didn't attend any church but insisted that I go to church, and that sort of grated a fair bit, and I couldn't get this sort of into my skull, really, this attitude of, you know, I don't care about it myself as an adult, but you kids are going to go there anyway because that's the way it's done. I prefer to look at it on the basis of when you're old enough, consider religion, but do it in your own good time and think about it in your own good time.
Frank, I think we could finish today's session at this point, if that's okay with you.
Yeah, fine, Barry.
And thanks.
We're covering a fair bit of field.
That's what it's all about. I hope you're enjoying it.
Yeah, absolutely.